Thank you for the lovely introduction and for the warm welcome. This is my first ever CCC, so thank you all for a really warm welcome. My name is Kate, and I direct a research program called the Children's Online Safety and Privacy Research, or COSPR program. This project deals with this topic, which has been at the center of heated debates from family dinner tables to morning talk shows and parliaments around the world. From age assurance and the social media ban to client-side scanning, we see over and over again how children's safety and adult privacy are pitted against each other. As people continue to grapple with the question of how to regulate tech and what kind of digital features we want to create for young people, this puts us in an impasse with children's safety and adult privacy on the other side, big tech accountability and tech apologism, moral panic versus Trojan horse, doing something versus doing nothing. And these binaries are not only inaccurate, but they paralyze all of us from actually engaging with the complex social, moral, political, and technological complexity that this topic holds. And this community, as technologists, parents, social workers, digital rights advocates, and all of us former children, have a unique positionality that can get us past this impasse, because this community has been at the forefront of imagining and shaping what a safe, secure, and collective digital futures might look like. And to do that, we need to have a fundamental reorientation in how we understand this problem area. I feel particularly well positioned to take you on this journey. I've spent the past 15 years of my experience in sexual violence prevention and response in frontline work, community organizing and advocacy, research, and policy. I, in fact, didn't really start out with an interest in tech, but soon I had to, because that's where the work took me. And when I did, I was startled by how the divide between privacy and safety came up again, again, and again, ultimately to the detriment of the people who are impacted by sexual violence. I started out on the front lines, providing direct support to survivors, many of them young, of sexual violence and family violence, first in the west and east coast of the US, and then in Seoul. And there I saw how sexual violence is always systemic. Capitalism, imperialism, and patriarchy created the conditions of migration, poverty, racism and colorism, transphobia and queerphobia, and disability, among others, where sexual violence emerged as a weapon of control, extraction, and dehumanization. As an organizer campaigning for survivors' rights, I saw how quick the criminal legal system was to dismiss tech-facilitated harms. Judges, lawyers, police officers, and social workers telling young women and children that they shouldn't have put their information out there, that if they're so worried, they should learn how the internet works, as if they do, or that they should just log off. And most recently, I worked in Google's child safety product policy team, where I was hoping to play a more tangible role in safeguarding young people's digital experiences. And instead, I saw how the tech industry's greed to feed its surveillance business model took advantage of young people. They claimed to care about privacy and safety, but it was a marketing exercise at best, a compliance checkbox exercise, as a company set aside truly innovative prevention ideas in favor of hyping up the AI bubble. I share my journey with you with the hope that it gives you a glimpse into what's at stake when we define this issue as one of safety and privacy. There's so much more when we allow ourselves to think beyond the impasse. So how did this impasse framing come about? Policy agenda has been primarily expressed by the concern for young people's mental health, but really, it's propelled and anchored by very particular ideas about child sexual abuse, and in the online context, child sexual abuse materials. So here, I think it's helpful to think about all of these laws kind of as a whole unit. So this is a map of latest legislative moves in different jurisdictions regarding children's online safety. So Australia has been leading the way with the social media minimum age restriction, which kicked off a few weeks ago. And also paving the way is the UK's Online Safety Act, which implemented age assurance methods this summer, and many of you have been tracking that. The EU continues its heated debates around chat control. I know Germany has had its own grappling with chat control very recently. as the DSA and DMA continue to kick in. And bolstered by what's happening in the EU, the US too is revisiting children's online safety discussions with the Kids Online Safety Act in the stacks for discussion in the next year. And the momentum from Australia is making its way to the Asian Pacific region, though there the focus has been on cyber sex crimes, particularly around financial sextortion. And similar regulatory momentum, it's making its ways to the African continent with Nigeria's online harms bill. And countries like Uganda and Ghana, with their anti-homosexuality bills, include substantive portion about online content moderation. And receiving less attention are events in Latin America, particularly in Brazil, which actually took a really innovative step forward this year in introducing a data governance framework for children. So when taken as a whole, these policies have three things in common. First is a vague definition of child safety that conjures a very strong mental model about child sexual abuse. So as we saw, child safety encompasses a whole range of different issues. We have grooming, child sexual abuse materials, sextortion, scams, misinformation, radicalization, mental health, and so on. And the fuzziness of child safety is what allows it to encompass all of these very different social phenomena. And it also leaves a lot for interpretation. So when you read the policy language closely or listen to the politicians' announcements and statements, it's really clear that they're constantly evoking and conjuring child sexual abuse and child sexual abuse materials as the strongest justification for why the internet needs to be regulated in this very protectionist way. So child safety itself might be vague, but this vagueness enables child sexual abuse to become a fixed mental model. And harm is reduced to content. Under this rhetoric, harm exists within the four corners of the content. Harm exists purely online, isolated from the complex interplay of online and offline factors. We lose sight of how risks differ from harm, how toddlers and teenagers are impacted differently, and how harm emerges from behaviors. This singular focus on content has the effect of diluting the motivations and incentives of the institutions and people that take advantage of and mistreat young people. Rather than addressing the root causes that create the predatory environment, the goal then is to remove harm by removing content through detection, reporting, and content removal. And solutions are thus privatized and punitive. It's no wonder that the proposed interventions are tech solutionist, as we see with things like age assurance methods, client-side scanning, reporting tools, grooming classifiers, you name them. But more importantly, these measures are privatized and singularly focused on punishment. They enable the tech industry to collect, consolidate, and centralize more data about everyone's private and intimate lives in the name of finding the bad guys who are hurting our children. We end up assuming that catching the bad guys means that young people are being protected. So these threads form what I call a child protectionist approach. So this is an approach to safeguarding young people that collapses meaningful differences in harms, motives, and impacts in order to justify taking a blunt, universalized law and order response. Now, protection itself isn't inherently harmful, and it might even be necessary at times. But this protectionist approach allows young people to be framed as frozen, as helpless victims, rather than complex people whose needs change and evolve over time. Safety is offered as a special carve-out for young people, as if they exist in isolation from other people. And risks and harms become one to warrant a blunt response that's more concerned about catching the imaginary predator than supporting young people. And protectionism has a way of taking over the discussion and pushing it to the extreme. It does so because child sexual abuse, and in online context, child sexual abuse materials, are fixed as a mental model. And this jump happens because of what my colleague Elizabeth Clements, who's a longtime restorative justice practitioner for people impacted by child sexual abuse, running this wonderful group called Hidden Water in New York, she calls this jump the result of the ick factor of child sexual abuse. So when child sexual abuse is evoked in a room, the room goes silent. I've seen it so many times. Everyone freezes up and avoids eye contact. People don't want to hear, think, or talk about it. They get the ick, and they try to avoid engaging with it. But a lot happens in this state of avoidance, and it's imperative that we, as responsible adults who care deeply about safeguarding young people in our lives and steering the internet towards a more liberatory future, to tackle this avoidance head on. Before I go on, I want to quickly set some intentions with you all because we're about to delve into heavier discussion. So content warning, I'll be speaking comprehensively and candidly about child sexual abuse, CSA, or child sexual abuse materials, or CSAM. And I know that that can be a really difficult task for a lot of different reasons. Maybe you're a concerned parent, maybe you work in this area, maybe you've been impacted in some way, or maybe you're having a hard time getting past the ick. So whatever the reason, I encourage you to engage with this on your own terms. And that might look like stepping away, taking notes, or not taking notes. For those of you calling in online, might mean that you take a pause and come back to it later. So whatever you do, that's all okay. You know your body, so follow your own pace. And if you choose to continue, be curious. There's a lot that we have to unlearn when it comes to this topic. I'm 15 years in and still finding myself unlearning and learning. So to do that kind of collective learning, relearning, and unlearning, you have to let yourself be curious. And curiosity happens when we allow ourselves to give each other and ourselves grace. And finally, learning is never solitary. It's a group effort, so I encourage you to check in with each other during and after the talk. Maybe you're sitting next to someone you've never met before, but maybe this is an opportunity for you to make new connections. So in the spirit of group care, I want to invite you all, this is totally optional, to do some collective breaths together with me. This helps us regulate so we can set aside whatever assumptions, projections, and anxieties that we're bringing into this topic. I like to do what's called a 3-2-4 breath. So I'm gonna inhale with, I'm gonna invite you all to inhale with our noses in a count of three, and then we're gonna hold our breath for two, and then we're gonna exhale while I count to four. So for those of you who want to, we can do this. So I'm gonna inhale in three, one, two, three, hold for two, and exhale, two, three, four. Let's do it one more time. Inhale, two, three, hold for two, exhale, two, three, four. Thank you for doing that with me. So let's return to the ick. Why do we get the ick? This avoidance is a response to our shared imaginaries about child sexual abuse, which mainly takes the shape in the figure of the predator. This figure of the predator is almost always imagined as an adult man with a pathological sexual interest in young children and predisposed to seek them out and abuse them. He goes by other names like sex offender, predator, pedophile, and groomer. But contrary to what we associate with the figure of the predator in our minds, the reality of child sexual abuse is much more complicated. So by far, about 90% of child sexual abuse, or CSA, involve people who are known and trusted by the child, and happens usually at home. So this is something that happens within the family system. And juvenile offending accounts for over 2/3 of CSA, meaning that it's something that happens within a peer-to-peer context. And the average age of difference is about 6 years, and often can involve older sibling or someone like an older sibling, like a cousin. So I think many of us who've been working in this area are familiar with the fact that it's something that happens within the family system. However, the figure of the predator is so prevalent in our culture, so that even those of us who consider ourselves pretty informed, the figure of the predator is so baked into our cultural fabric, from reality shows like To Catch a Predator, there's a new show on HBO Max, for those of you who have it, with It, the Pennywise, and true crime podcast. So it's so baked into our culture that it constantly sets us back from actually confronting the realities of CSA. And as a result, the ick masks systemic factors that enable CSA in our own families, communities, and institutions. It presents the story that CSA is this awful one-off incident, but the truth is that it's something that happens throughout the life course, or that its effects unravel throughout the life course of a person. So for 78% of children who experience CSA, it happened more than once, and for 42%, it happened more than six times. It also happens always in tandem with other forms of child maltreatment. In a study in Australia, 4 in 10 children experience more than one type of abuse, such as neglect, physical violence, emotional violence, exposure to domestic violence. And it tends to involve, implicate people who are already vulnerable, marginalized, and displaced. So the likelihood and severity of CSA are linked to gender. Girls are at a risk for most types of child maltreatment, particularly for sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and neglect. Although I do want to note that this might also be as a result of the fact that we have historically overlooked the impact on young boys, and this is a growing area of research. Children with disabilities are 3 times more likely than children without to experience CSA. And children in the foster care system are more likely to have higher lifetime experiences of CSA. And this isn't something that is not only, the figure of the predator is not just inaccurate as we're seeing, but it actually actively harms the children and adults who are impacted. Delayed disclosure is really common for people impacted by CSA. Disclosures can happen anywhere between a week after the incident to 46 years later, and 66% of episodes are never disclosed to an adult. So to recap, we've seen how a protectionist approach has come to prevail in our regulatory and cultural and moral understanding of child safety. And the ick factor of CSA is so powerful that it keeps us fixated on this figure of the predator and diverts our attention away from the realities of CSA. So how then has the ick factor shaped children's online safety? Well, the story of protectionism in children's online safety, in many ways, is a story of an ecosystem, one that is constantly reproducing itself and ever expanding. It's a story about this ecosystem premised on big, scary numbers, one that's designed to chase those numbers, and in doing so, cast real people aside in pursuit of what those numbers mean, or in pursuit of what the numbers represent. So we start with the big, scary numbers that shock us and divert us away from the real child safety issue. So when it comes to online safety, CSAM, child sexual abuse materials, come to stand in for the figure of the predator. So take this really commonly cited stat, you can see it in policy documents, in media discussions, about CSAM from NCMEC, or the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and this is a US-based national clearinghouse for processing CSAM reports. In 2023, NCMEC alleges that they received 36.2 million reports of suspected child sexual exploitation. This is a jarring and horrifying number. So we have this big, scary number about CSAM that conveys this idea that the internet is inundated with CSAM. Well, let's unpack this. Because the internet is run by internet service providers, the ESPs are under US federal obligation to report what they think might be CSAM. So US federal law requires electronic service providers, or ESP, to detect, report, and remove suspected child sexual abuse materials to the cyber tip line, which is run by NCMEC. And then that kind of beckons a question of like, well, what exactly is CSAM? How do you know that it's suspected CSAM? So when we interrogate it, we see that CSAM is a very particular legal object that's rooted in very American set of values, that's both over and under-inclusive of how child sexual abuse and exploitation might be captured as pieces of content. So in this definition, we see that CSAM refers to any visual depiction of sexually explicit conduct involving an apparent minor. I want to highlight the 3 key components of this definition. First is visual depiction, and this is something that actually varies by jurisdiction. Some jurisdictions include text-based material, audio, and so on, but in the US definition, there's kind of an overemphasis on visual materials. Sexually explicit conduct. In the US definition, this really is defined by the presence of genitalia and penetrative sex acts. So we can see how a very particular heterosexual notion of sexual violence is inscripted into the law. And apparent minor. The word apparent is doing a lot of work. So there's an assumption here that you can distinguish a child's body from an adult body. So as a result of this really vague, both over and under-inclusive definition, the cyber tip line ends up including a whole lot of different things. So first, it includes genuine child sexual abuse and exploitation materials. So these are images and other types of content captured during actual instances of abuse and exploitation. But it also includes something like the baby bum on the beach. So this is your grandma taking a picture of her naked grandson running around the beach. So it might meet the legal definition of CSAM, but certainly isn't sexually motivated, and it's innocuous by all means. It also includes something like nudes, which the industry parlance is self-generated CSAM. And it's older adolescents who are engaging in developmentally normative behavior to capture and share intimate imagery. It might be innocuous, it might become harmful in the cases of non-consensual image circulation, but of course you wouldn't necessarily know that from just looking at the image. It also includes reshares, another horrible industry parlance called potential meme. So this refers to people who are resharing CSAM that's already been known and detected, either to raise awareness about it or from a sense of outrage or to troll other people. So various motivations there, but the idea is that it's a reshare of what's already out there on the internet. And it also includes obscene visual content. So these are your animated content, things that are generated to replicate the image of a real child. So just from looking at all of this, we can see how CSAM really is a legal object that's not necessarily, though can be, a proxy for hands-on abuse and exploitation. So as a result, there's a great disparity in the actionability of cyber tips. So of the 36.2 cyber tips in 2023, when we break it down, law enforcement found 49% of that to be actionable. This means that there was enough information with the report from the ESPs that they were able to do something about the investigation. And 3% of the total was referred to law enforcement. And at the end of the day, 0.18% of the total 36 million, so that's 63,892 cyber tips, escalated for likely involving real hands-on abuse of a real child. Now, I want to actually sit with this number because this is a harrowing number, but I think it's important to note that this whole system is designed for this final number, but then we see this great disparity between the 36.2 million that we started with and then the 63,000 tips that we ended up with. So how did this actually happen? How do we make sense of this gap in actionability? Well, like we've been kind of circling around, to be able to identify whether real abuse and exploitation happened, sometimes a picture can be an encapsulation of that, but most often than not, that context of harm lives outside of the four corners of the content. So to determine the presence of abuse, you need contextual information, like the presence or absence of consent and the nature of the harmful behavior. So is it coercion, controlling behavior, threats, monitoring and surveillance, deception, manipulation, non-consensual sharing, or exploitation? Like I said, images between two teenagers going through puberty who are dating, they might want to share intimate imagery, but the minute that one partner decides to share that with other people non-consensually, that's become now a harmful behavior, but the photo didn't change, right? It's the context surrounding it. Motivation, was it innocuous? We saw how people are sharing CSAM out of outrage, so it can be something that's done innocuously or people who are curious. To egregious, out of a desire for coercion or revenge. or sexually motivated by the desire to humiliate and coerce, or non-sexual, like in the case of financial sextortion, where lots of scammers have identified that sexual interest is a really good way to lure the interest of young people and elderly people because they're particularly susceptible to interest like that. So it might take on a sexual connotation, but the real motivation behind it is financial. And relationality. So what's the age difference between the people involved? What are the power differential? Is it an adult and a child? Is it an older child and a younger child? Is it a teacher and a student? And what's the nature of the relationship between them? So when we put all of this together, what we see is that rather than referring to all of them as child sexual abuse or exploitation material, really what we're talking about is child sexual material. And I think it's important to name it as such because that is what's being captured under the guise that it might lead to the 63,000 that we ended up with, but not necessarily. So essentially this creates this ecosystem that's designed to chase numbers. And here is a map of the ecosystem. So at the very top, we have the electronic service providers. So these are your Googles and your Metas and your Microsofts, and also the telcos like Verizon. And their compliance requirement is to design and apply proprietary detection technologies. And the idea is that they would pass it over to the law enforcement and regulators, whose job is to investigate CSM tips for policing responses. And we've seen increasingly how entities like the eSafety Commissioner or Ofcom are playing an active role in facilitating this process of communication and compliance between the ESPs and law enforcement. This has also led to the creation of lobbyists and campaigner organizations, and their job is to raise awareness about CSM tip reporting. And they work very closely with the clearinghouses and the tip lines. So these are often government-appointed charities that collect, review, and refer CSM tips from ESPs and members of the public and maintain a database of them. And this entire interaction between the actors has also led to the growing, very lucrative marketplace of what I call the tech solutions vendors. So these are third-party tech companies, often without substantive child safety expertise, who are developing and selling compliance technologies to sell to the other ecosystem actors. So it might be an analyst review tooling kit, it might be Intel research report, and so on. So the ecosystem that we're seeing here, it's constantly reproducing itself and constantly expanding. And I mean, I'm sitting in front of a room full of technologists, so I don't have to tell you about the algorithmic harms and how they compound as this ecosystem continues to rely on detection. So these compounding harms of automated, mandated reporting, it works like a loop. You're constantly caught in it, and sometimes it's hard to even name and identify what kind of harms are happening within. So like we said, in the offline context, a lot of child sexual abuse happens within a peer-to-peer context, and that applies in the online context as well. So 44% of CSAM offenders are under the age of 18. And 68% of CSAM offenders are known to the child. And with online commercial sexual exploitation, so it means that there's some kind of a monetary exchange involving CSAM, most, in fact, 92% are self-negotiated by the young people, with the primary motivation being money. So we see that it's not a clear black and white picture of abuse and exploitation that we are, you know, conjuring in our mind, but rather a really complicated picture that also implicates young people as well. And it also has a disparate impact on people with neurodivergence. There's a lot of emphasis on how young people with neurodivergence are likely to be victimized, but they're also at a higher risk for offending. Online offending disproportionately implicate adolescents, particularly those with autism spectrum disorder. There's also racial disparity as well. And this is in the context of broader child protective services in the US, but I think we can extrapolate from this. White and non-Latinx children's cases of physical and sexual violence in the US are more likely to be substantiated than Black and Latinx children. This means that allegations of sexual and physical violence from lighter-skinned children are more likely to be believed than from darker-skinned children. And this entire ecosystem, of course, it's something that's exported at a global scale, so it's reproducing the digital divide. And one way that we can see the impact of that is through the, again, racial disparity in the data set. And this is something that's known within the ecosystem actors, although it's something that's rarely mentioned. So while child sexual abuse itself is universal across regions, cultures, countries, CSM cyber tips mostly feature white children, and arrested viewers are mostly white. Now, there are many reasons for this. It might have to do with internet connectivity. It might have to do with jurisdictional compliance with their CSM reporting. It might have to do with access to devices. It might also have to do with how we racialize innocence and how that might come through in these detection ecosystems. We simply don't know, but there is, we can use this information to look into how racial disparity from collection, processing, to investigations might come through. And this whole system exists on hash matching technology, which is developed to identify materials that have already been vetted to be true positive pieces of CSAM. But many victims of CSAM are actually not aware that their imagery is being used to train these models of detection. In a recent survey of 80 survivors of CSAM, 60% were aware that their material was retained by the police, 45% knew that it was used by tech companies, and 35% knew that it was being used by researchers. But that leaves a whole lot of people who had no idea that their images were being used to train these models. And of course, 90% of those interviews said that they wanted to know. So when we kind of take a step back and go back to the ecosystem map, you also notice that this ecosystem is actually missing a few key actors. And that's because this ecosystem exists in separation from a much smaller ecosystem, one that's been in existence for a lot longer, and the one that is constantly shrinking and chronically underfunded. It's the ecosystem that's run by the frontline service providers. So these are people who are directly interfacing with young people to provide them with direct support. These are your therapists, shelters, caseworkers, and treatment programs. These are your helpline operators. These are resources that exist to protect your confidentiality and give you informal advice and provide you with coping strategies. And youth-serving organizations, so your guidance counselors in schools, nurses, after-school programs, and so on. And not only is this a smaller ecosystem, this smaller ecosystem is constantly being pulled in by the bigger ecosystem through things like funding and opportunities for visibility. Now, you might ask that, well, surely the detection ecosystem must exist for a reason, that it must be doing something right. Well, that depends on how we measure impact. And that impact comes down to numbers versus people. Many people don't know that the ecosystem map that we saw in the previous slide are of two separate ecosystems. So on one hand, we have detection, and on one hand, we have prevention. And we're taught to assume that they're one and the same. We think that catching the bad guys means that we're providing support to young people, but these are actually very different projects. We assume that detection is helping, and we assume that reporting is helping, and that's simply not true. Too often, the resource provided to young people, like the one listed on the major ESP's Help Center pages, is a link to hotlines. And hotlines, like NCMEC's Cyber Tip Line, are used for reporting illegal materials and operated by people with mandated reporting obligations. This is separate from helplines, warm lines, lifelines, a bunch of different names that are used purposely to distinguish them from hotlines, because they can actually promise you some degree of privacy, anonymity, and confidentiality, and offer you a range of skill sets. So when people are subjected to mandated reporting, it ends up doing more harm than good. It's really difficult to get information about mandated reporting in CSM context. So here I have a piece of similar data that we can extrapolate from domestic violence survivors. And a fair number of those surveyed were also underage. So in a survey of 3,616 domestic violence survivors and help seekers in the US, more than half said mandated reporting, which brought in law enforcement intervention, made their situation worse. So here we see 50% said that it made it much worse, 12% said it made it a little worse, 20% that it made no difference, 15% that it got a little better, and 3% said much better. So we see how mandated reporting, even though it's a system that exists under the auspice that it must be supporting survivors, is actually actively detrimental to their help-seeking journeys. And sometimes providers will share and disclose the fact that they actually can't keep information confidential, and actually warnings about mandated reporting also reduce the help-seeking ability. And when it comes to the CSM context, people do seek help, but we're not always there to provide them with the support that they need. So in a recent research, 70% of those who sought help in relation to their CSM viewing habits were not able to receive help. And this is a real detriment, because help seeking is integral to child sexual abuse prevention, both for the young people and the old people who are sexually harmed and the youth who have sexually harmed others. But many mandated reporting requirements, stigma, and lack of resources create systemic barriers. And in actual help-seeking journey, privacy and safety are integral. Young people, particularly young men, are more likely to seek help from online services because they're freely accessible, they're anonymous, and they're stigma-reducing than the traditional opportunities. And the people who are best positioned to do it are youth workers. So these are the people in the smaller ecosystem. And yet, we currently live in a time of severe austerity, particularly cuts to social services. So we see the people with the most resources and the skill sets and the training to be able to play an active role in supporting young people's help-seeking journey unable to do so. So to recap, we've seen how the ick factor of big scary numbers paves way for an ever-expanding and self-reproducing ecosystem of CSM detection that's designed to chase numbers and serve numbers over people. So how do we break out of this loop of detection and policing and punishment? We need a radical paradigm shift. Instead of big, scary numbers, we need to attend to lived stories of people impacted by the detection ecosystem. We rarely hear them, but they are out there. Instead of chasing numbers, we need to nourish the help-seeking ecosystem. And instead of numbers over people, we need to listen to the people, and we need to support and care for all people impacted, overlooked, and cast aside by this ecosystem that's powered by tech and fueled by the carceral desire to punish. And that's how we begin healing together, by investing in prevention. Prevention is a public health concept about taking proactive measures to avoid the onset, progression, and impact of child sexual abuse online and offline. And this is how we get closer to enduring child safety. So if we imagine our community as a tree, our detection and punishment-driven approach to CSA makes that tree look like this. It's a desiccated, shriveling, and sharp tree. At the primary level of prevention, which is for everybody to learn about child sexual abuse, we do some work here, but we, for the most part, keep people in a state of ignorance and teach them individual practices like consent education, rather than creating environments that are more conducive to a safer relationship. At the secondary level, which is for people who are at a higher risk of both offending and victimization, we make it really difficult because, again, it's the youth workers who are interfacing with young people who are in the best position, but we are cutting funding and resources going to them. At the tertiary level, which is to create conditions for offense and victimization-free life, we do very little again. Like we said, child sexual abuse isn't something that just happens once and then you forget about it. It's something that happens and it's embedded into how we experience systemic forms of violence. So people need ongoing support, but we rarely offer chronic long-term resources. And then quaternary prevention, which is really the principle of do no harm. And on this regard, we do very little. And in fact, we actively don't do quaternary prevention because we have things like mandated reporting that continue to strip resources from people. But what if we made different choices? What if we can have a thriving, healthy, and abundant tree with lush leaves and ripe fruits and blooming flowers? Then we might have a prevention tree that looks more like this. We provide people with comprehensive sex and intimacy education. We teach people about consent, both in offline relational contexts and digital. We provide anonymous and resource therapeutic support at the secondary level, and we train youth-serving professionals to identify healthy and harmful behaviors in young people. At the tertiary level, we provide long-term, non-stigmatizing resources at a local level. And then at the quaternary level, we abolish things like mandated reporting, and instead we invest our resources into care and community and prevention. Now, I've said a lot of this, and these are great social policies that I think for many of you here are great ideas, but lives a little outside of the realm of control for you all. But one of the reasons why I really wanted to have this talk with this community is because I genuinely think this community has a unique positionality. So what can the CCC community do? Well, take safety seriously to develop innovative help-seeking tools. We saw that help-seeking is integral to prevention and that privacy and anonymity and confidentiality are integral. So what might that look like? What might help-seeking tools that actually support young people's journey look like? Also, help shape regulatory path with tech alternatives paired with compelling messaging. You'll notice back in the ecosystem map that technologists were missing in the ecosystem map. And I think often it is because technologists have sat on the sidelines saying, this is moral panic, or this is Trojan horse going tisk tisk, that can't be done, or that's not the way to do it. Well, unfortunately, but also in an opportunistic way, there's a lot of appetite right now to see some kind of tech regulation, and we can't deny that. There are aggrieved parents, teachers, who are genuinely concerned about how tech is impacting their young people, but they don't necessarily understand tech. But I'm here in this room, sitting in front of you all with the technical expertise. You have the skills to translate what technology means to other people, and that is an incredible set of resources that you can harness to shape the regulatory path in a more constructive direction. And finally, through shared expertise, build critical connections with frontline and child rights groups. So these are people with resources and expertise that can be partnering with you all to think about what the messaging looks like, to think about what those features look like. And you can do it in a skill-sharing manner. You can offer to do, data audit. You can offer to do security audit and data literacy trainings and so on. So it's a way to really build and share expertise between the two groups. So if you really want to break and resist the carceral systems that are expanding, what we need are critical connections. And these critical connections are not just strategically savvy, it is how we build power, and it is how we enact change, by showing those people who cannot imagine a world outside of detection and policing that another way is possible, that there's another way of being, another way of treating each other and being in community with each other, and that another way of world making is possible. And this isn't rocket science. In fact, young people have been telling this to us all along. So this is a research from Crisis Text Line, which is a text-based mental health resource for young people who are English and Spanish speaking. And every year they ask young people who've accessed their services, what are the things that you wish that you had? So they said that they wanted opportunities for social connection, engagement in music, writing, and arts, mental health services, exercise and sports programming, books and audiobooks, outdoor spaces, and nature. And you'll notice that there's technology implicated in all of these. Every one of these require us to break the impasse so we can think boldly and creatively about how to bring together privacy and safety in allowing young people to access these resources. So as a final kind of wrap-up thought, I wanted to share this quote from Grace Lee Boggs, who is an American feminist organizer and thinker. She says, social change is never a question of critical mass, although critical mass would be nice to have. It's always about critical connections. So I encourage you to break out of the impasse framing and think about what critical connections you have in your life to bridge this impasse together. Thank you.
Thank you so much.